Welcome to Section 31 headquarters.
Are those mines?
Blade mines. They'll slice a hole like cheese.
This is your captain. Brace for a bumpy ride.
Shields down to 41%.
The hell is that?
What is Arium doing? Michael.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, the worst, the weirdest, the wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, looking at the cold, cold heart of death out at the airlock.
And we're here this week to talk about episode 9 of season 2, Discovery, Project Daedalus.
What is Project Daedalus?
I think it's a sequel to that great Enterprise episode, Daedalus.
I love the fact that the entire episode was named after something that they don't even know what it is by the end of the episode. But for us, I think the big question we want to jump into here is the whole Arium gets an arc in the course of one episode. And look, this is kind of a non-character for the first season and a half. And I'm wondering how this worked for you, suddenly giving this character who was kind of the bee's knees in terms of like fandom amongst, you know, everybody who just was totally enthralled by just the cool look of this character.
Yeah.
Suddenly gets an arc. And I don't know about you, it worked for me in this one single episode.
Yeah, I really love the Arium stuff. I mean, I was concerned. Last week was a big event. We got to see Talos. We got to see, you know, a character in a confused, jumbled state find themselves again. We got to see a fearsome group headed by an AI. But that was just Captain Marvel. There was also, of course, the Star Trek episode, which was really good. So we had all that stuff happen.
In contrast to Captain Marvel.
Yeah, which was okay. But I had to pull that one out.
I liked it, though. Yeah.
But anyways, you know, that episode had so many momentous moments that I was just like, how are we ever, you know, like, I really thought this was going to be the weak episode. Like, the kind of the filler episode of, like, okay, let's build to the inevitable Red Angel stuff. And this was an episode that I'm a little frustrated with in the sense of, like, I think it's an okay episode with great, great stuff in it. But the all the Arium stuff was what I really latched onto. I was really pleased right out of the gate when we had all the stuff with her accessing her memories, giving us that backstory. But I will say, and this is nothing, not to take away from the emotion of the episode or the loss of this character or any of the cool stuff that, you know, Hannah Cheeseman got to do in this one episode. But I realized she was gone before it happened. Mm. Just because I was like, why are they giving this character so many moments, especially things where she's talking about, you know, her husband or partner, you know, in the shuttle crash. I'm like, they do not throw that dialogue in there in an episode where Arium makes it to next week.
They're definitely telegraphing stuff just based on all of those obvious signals. But here's what I kept questioning. Well, Discovery has a long history of faking deaths. You know, we saw that earlier this season with Saru, where they walked back on that death.
Sure.
And
but they can't do it twice in a season.
I would think that maybe Discovery would try.
Right.
I honestly, at a certain point, wasn't really sure because Burnham was insisting she was going to find a way. We can dive into the logic of that. And the other thing you mentioned, though, is like this was punctuated by some exceptional moments in an episode that I thought was a little uneven, but
I spent a lot of it just going, where is this episode going? Like, a lot of it I was like, what is this episode even about?
Well, and that's like a question I'm always asking myself whenever I am watching an episode. What is the central story that they're telling, and are they accomplishing what they set out to do here? I thought they did that exceptionally well last episode with regards to the return to Talos.
A real highlight episode for me.
Yeah. In this one, it's interesting in that Discovery has seemed to fall into a pattern in which they will have one episode very climactic, a lot of great stuff going on, and the next episode seems to be kind of a place setter, you know, like just putting all the pieces, you know, together, setting things up for the one to follow.
Right.
This seemed to fall into that pattern
for most of the episode.
Save for the fact, I have to say this, and we'll dive into it further, but let's start with the Arium stuff. Save for the fact that Arium arc as well as the Spock and Burnham showdown that I think was quite exceptional as well.
I agree.
And this is not going to be the Spock that is going to be pleasing a lot of those hardcore fans out there, but I think there is some very, very interesting stuff going on that actually fits in with the character and his whole history, and I want to get into that later, but I think what we got to deal with the Arium stuff. And for me, what really worked here, and I'm always skeptical when they try to shove in like a whole arc in one episode, especially for such an ancillary character, but it's really the Tilly connection that really did it in for me, where I bought into this. I totally bought that there is like a special relationship between her and these bridge members that don't really get that much time. You know, it's better for me that we get to see these regular bridge crew other than the rotating, you know, background players that we saw in Next Generation.
Yeah.
Save for there was that one navigator who was on The Amazing Race that I do recall from a couple of years ago. But look, I thought this was just...
Boston Rob.
Yes, I only fear we're alienating so much of our listeners by making more Survivor references and Amazing Race references that only you and I will understand. But look, I thought this was great. And I did buy the moments, the sharing of the memories, despite the fact that her fondest memory seemed to be on the coldest beach in the history of great honeymoons or whatever sort of vacation she and her partner were on.
So what beach in Toronto was that?
I think there, it had to be like Lake Ontario somewhere, And it was just like, oh, that looked frigid.
Yeah, and her husband or fiance or boyfriend or whoever looked a lot like Kenneth Mitchell.
I see. I was thinking he looked a lot more like, say, Diego Luna.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Or, you know, like I kind of picked up that vibe. I honestly, I don't think he looked like Kenneth Mitchell whatsoever.
Maybe it's just the goatee. Maybe I just like think all guys with goatees look the same.
Does Kenneth Mitchell have a goatee?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
He didn't
in Captain Marvel, I don't think, though.
No. Another Star Trek Discovery connection to the biggest movie at the box office right now.
Yeah.
So there you go. And also a sci-fi property.
Right.
Ken, we got so many questions for you about your sci-fi experience on Captain Marvel.
Right.
So I can't wait. But for you, okay. What do you think it takes to do like a real death scene in Star Trek that actually has consequences, that actually seems to matter to the characters? And do you think Discovery accomplished that?
Well, I mean, I would have said prior to this episode, I would have said, you know, a long history with a character, because I think of like, you know, the death of Spock or even the death of Jadzia. I didn't like the way it happened. Like, I thought that episode was pretty clunky, but the actual death scene and her saying goodbye to Worf, we've lived with these characters for a long time, so you have this built-up emotion.
Yeah.
We didn't really have that with Arium. So I think a lot of it honestly comes down to Mary Wiseman's performance.
Mm.
Because Tilly is a character, someone we have, I feel like, a lot more empathy for than a lot of the other characters on the show. She's the one that is in many ways the most relatable in, you know, our 21st century human perspective, because she just feels like, in a way, like kind of like the Star Trek fan on the bridge.
Exactly.
And so when we see her having this, you know, tearful goodbye to Arium, I think we're responding more to her in some ways than Arium, because, you know, the Arium, just the actress in that costume, like that is a mask she's wearing. It's very tough to read emotions in it. She does a lot with her voice, to be fair. Like, I thought the Arium farewell stuff was really strong. But I do think having that 1-2 punch of what it means to Tilly, as well as what it means to Burnham, as well as just the shots of the rest of the crew.
And the reason why you can be skeptical of this is because we didn't really get to know the character before this episode.
Yeah, and that's something you can really hold against the series, not so much this episode, in that we spent so many episodes, I think we gave up most of this season, just saying, what's going on with Arium?
Right.
Like season one, we spent a lot of time being like, well, who is that awesome character? Why is she not doing anything? And then when we got to season two, it just became the norm, and we were like, don't even mention her.
She did get much more to do this season than she did in season one, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
And look, it is kind of a fascinating journey when you take like an episodic series, which has the ability to do kind of like a bottle episode to a certain degree. Not that this was a typical bottle episode, although it was primarily ship-based and like, you know, of course, like redecorated corridors that was used for Section 31's home base.
Right.
But in
really nice base they got there.
Sure. Yeah. But in this situation, I like the fact that you can kind of take a bottle episode like this, make you invested in a character for over a very short period of time, and the stakes actually matter. I mean, this is no Edith Keeler sort of situation.
Sure.
But
that's actually a really good comparison, actually, in the sense of like,
it worked in like a single episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that character's arc exists entirely in one episode as well. Yeah.
So for me, and
but
like,
how much do you think with Edith Keeler's death? Again, it's what Shatner's bringing to it.
Of course, that is, and that's why I think Mary Wiseman's a great analog in this situation to what Shatner was doing. Look, this is also benefiting very much from the mechanisms that they have to work with as an augmented sort of cyber being, and that we can access her memories in a way that doesn't seem super clunky if, like, I'm having a dream right
Right. The only other way you could get away with it maybe is if, say, for example, if Star Trek II, which this had a little moments too of, like, burning with her hand on the glasses again, but if you had, like, say Spock in that moment had done some sort of mind meld with Kirk, and you got, like, a flashback to moments in their friendship, you get away with it, like, Vulcan characters, but for the most part, no, it's not something you could do.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical of people having dreams. Like, it sometimes it can be done well on TV and movies, but other times I just think it's rather clunky.
Right.
And look, this worked
for
me.
This is the best, and this is a very sci-fi way to do it.
Yeah.
And I thought the emotion was there. Like, sometimes sci-fi can play as cold. And I actually think this did not at all, like, this way to tackle this sort of situation.
How ironic, since she froze to death in space.
That's grim.
Yeah. But okay, beyond kind of the emotional punch, there is very much kind of a story element that's going on here. Mm-hmm. I think I just interrupted you. Had one final thought here?
Yeah, I was just wondering how you felt about the actual flashback moments we got with Arium to her various relationships with the crew that we never got to see on the show very much, but I really liked them, although you and I were both kind of amused by one of them.
Yeah, when Michael turned to Arium and had, like, the creepiest sort of, like, Chucky from Child's Play sort of smile on her face, I said to you, oh, that is going to be a gif if I ever saw one.
Yeah, I thought that was something.
It was interesting.
I did love, though, that it gave us another little outlet into the other crew members with, like, Awashkin and, you know, Detmer. Like, characters, I do really appreciate that Season 2 Discovery has given those characters a lot more moments to shine. And this was another way to do it, where it's just, like, find ways to work them in organically.
Going back to the Burnham image, though, was that
I'll never forget it.
But was that not from when they were analyzing that organic sphere from a couple episodes ago?
I mean, it could be.
Because I remember there was that moment where they were gazing out the window, and then Burnham commented on it. And I'm wondering if that was meant to be from kind of the same moment. I think it kind of makes a lot of sense if it was.
Yeah.
And you can kind of tell, I think, based on the lighting, because I recall that was kind of a golden hue throughout that episode because of that organic being. And this had that same golden hue throughout. So, I don't know. I just thought that was kind of an interesting callback if it was intentional.
How do you compare the Arium death to the Saru almost death?
Well, Saru is a character I think we're far more invested in.
Sure.
And we did feel a little bit yanked around about whether or not Saru is actually going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And look, you can find my feelings on that in our previous episode, A Noble for Charon. I believe that was the episode that dealt with that. And so how did this compare? Look, I'm not as broken up over this as I would have been had Saru passed away very early on into his tenure here on this particular series. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, the Saru one, I thought, was just carried a lot of the heavier emotions with it. The thing is, like, in that episode, you had Burnham really pouring out her feelings to Saru. And the thing is, we've seen these feelings play out. Whereas when Tilly's talking about her great friendship with Arium, we're like, well, I mean, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, it all happened pretty much off screen. And that's, you know, which is a detriment to the character. I wish they'd just done more with her leading up to this, because, you know, I thought this was really fantastically realized, but just imagine they'd built up Arium through season one and into season two. Like, this moment would have just been, like, shocking.
This is the best death that any background player can ever hope for on a Star Trek series. You know, this isn't even like, say, Rom or Nog passing away. This, like, because we're so much more invested in those characters. So
this is like Morn.
This is, no, because, like, even Morn, like, had, like, 150 appearances, you know? This is, like, what, maybe 15 appearances?
Is this kind of like O'Brien, had he died in, like, season 2 of TNG?
More like, episode 20 of TNG.
Right,
It would be
around Skin of Evil?
Yeah.
Armus gets him, too?
instead of Tar. Yar. I said Tar.
Fair enough.
Armus, so. Yeah, so, look. Beyond kind of the emotional stuff that's going on here, there are some very specific story elements. I think one of which it is maybe telegraphing kind of the future of the Spore Drive. What was Arium's job really going to be? Because she is the spore drive operator.
Yes.
And so we keep wondering what the future is of the spore drive, especially since we know that it is destroying the fabric of this one alien species and they
right.
keep using it. And we also know that it is destroying the DNA of one Lieutenant Commander Stamets.
Right.
So we know that there's a limited lifespan on the spore drive. So maybe they do want to give the spore drive operator a bit of a good showing before she's unceremoniously dispatched.
Yeah, I mean, had Saru been the spore drive operator, I would have just said, well, they'll find another job for him. There's yeah. a lot you can do with that character, but the fact is...
Waste extraction.
Exactly. It just keeps cutting to him, like, down in this, like, dingy boiler room. He's like, I'm working on it, Captain.
I'm giving her all she's got.
But, I mean, with a character like Arium, who has not been fleshed out at all, yeah, you know that, like, why have that character? It's not like they're going to bend over backwards if they phase out the spore drive to be like, well, we've got to give this character who yeah. isn't an actual character more to do.
Yeah, I mean, what would she be doing? Like, I guess Burnham's science helper?
Well,
how many science...
What about chief engineer at this point?
Well, I don't know. We still don't know who the chief engineer is.
Tig Notaro's still wandering around those sets somewhere.
I don't know. Are we ever going to see like the real main engineering? Because they've already told us that yeah. Stamets' room is not main engineering, despite the fact that right. we can see engines there. I don't know. But yeah. Okay, so beyond the spore drive limited availability throughout mm-hmm. the series, the other thing is that we're getting kind of a story arc being fleshed out with the whole AI stuff that's going
yeah,
on here. And
yeah.
I have some questions about this, and maybe just talking about it aloud, and you can help me out with this.
Sure.
So when we first saw that, you know, Arium had been compromised.
Right.
I thought it was because of that 25th century probe had
gotten
into her. That
was what I thought, yes.
But this kind of implies that it's, in fact, the present day control, a.k.a. the AI system that is guiding a lot of Starfleet decisions. Does that mean that control has already been compromised by some elements of the 25th century, or did we just totally misinterpret what had happened a few episodes ago with regards to that probe that
No, I'm positive that that probe came back from the future had done that to Arium. So
she's been programmed to help out control in the present day.
Yes.
So does that tell you that control has been compromised by the 25th century elements?
I think so, because that would also make sense in terms of paving the way from this Section 31 into something closer to the 24th century. Like,
yeah.
because they were not talking in 24th century. Sloan was not going on about how control had, you know, they needed Bashir. Like, control really likes you, Bashir.
Speaking of other things that they didn't really cared too much about by the 24th century, mines. They're a big part of Deep Space Nine with
yeah.
the whole mining of the wormhole. But...
I laughed when Pike's like, the Federation doesn't approve mines. And I'm like, Sisko does.
Yeah.
Meh, 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 meh. It's like guitar solo.
So that's an interesting thing. So look, and this is what I love about Star Trek is that there's so much applicability to kind of real world, say, anxieties that are going on right now. Because I think one of the big things that people are trying to grapple with is what the future of, say, AI and automation means for
yeah.
society. I think it's causing a lot of anxiety, some of it unnecessary, some of it warranted when you just think about what the future of certain professions are going to be.
Yeah.
A lot of jobs are going to be eliminated because of automation.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of tapping into some, you know, present day anxieties, which I think is just really fascinating that Star Trek is able to do that. How warranted it is that, you know, the robots are all going to come and kill us.
Right.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know that the robopocalypse is on the horizon. But I do think that's a really interesting topic to tackle. And I'm really looking forward to see how they kind of resolve it.
Yeah.
Because I think it's easy at this point to just be like, oh, the big bad AI is going to wipe out all life in the galaxy, which is a little similar to the spore drive wiping out all life in the galaxy in the
yeah.
Mirror Universe arc. Like,
yeah, that's right.
You know, come on, Star Trek. We don't need to be doing the the entire reality is going to be ruined because of this every season.
It was a concern that we had after the season one. Like, how are you supposed to constantly be raising the stakes?
Yeah.
And I guess every single season, it's like all of, you know, life as we know it is,
yeah.
you know, at risk right now.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
They just changed the theme song to the REM song. It's the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just play that every single week on Star Trek Discovery.
I thought you were going to say Losing My Religion.
Well, that would actually work for season two, at least.
With Pike, yeah.
Yeah, with Pike, yeah, yeah.
It's the sappiest sort of melancholy Star Trek season we've ever experienced, you know.
But yeah, do you think they've said anything intelligent about AI yet, or is it more just kind of what's scary? Like, you know, we've got like five episodes left in season two. We could get some really interesting insights into AI, but I don't know that we've got there yet.
No, I don't think we have. Nothing profound, nothing super philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're going to go there. I think this is more...
Well, they've also hid it behind a smokescreen for most of the season. We're just getting it really revealed now.
It's so. Okay. Like, because they've kind of dropped hints. We know that they've been going in this direction. I think the biggest hint of all that we weren't really clued into going into season one was, of course, from the short trek Calypso, where we had Zara, the AI system aboard Discovery, that was allowed to evolve for, what, like 800 years, 900 years? And, I really wonder how we're going to go and view Calypso after season two wraps up.
That story must tie into this season in some way.
If you look at the time travel elements, if you look at the AI elements, both of which were present in Calypso, I think that is a very important story. We've already been told just through, say, The Brightest Star, how important that is as well with regards to Saru's arc. I'm just waiting for Poe to make a return and for Harry Mudd to be tied in. To me, it's kind of strange Harry Mudd hasn't showed up, after nine episodes.
Is he going to? We're getting to the end of season two. I have a hard time just imagining them bringing Harry Mudd in for like the last two or three episodes.
I'm sure they can find a way. Would you have expected him to have appeared in like an episode like Magic to make the Sanus Man go mad?
Not necessarily, but those are also in like the first six episodes or something, or the first eight episodes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we still haven't had a return visit from Laurel yet. Like, I feel like there's other things to pay off.
Yeah.
Harry Mudd usually works a little more standalone. We'll see. I mean, but that said, if they're introducing AI and Harry Mudd is the one making androids, you just never know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It does kind of line up. So we could see something there.
Will we get the ultimate sort of Spielbergian sort of shout out by casting Haley Joel Osment as one of these robots, Cam?
Who's the blue fairy?
Okay. Will we get Jude Law as a gigolo? Like, that's what I want to know. Another connection to Captain Marvel.
Wasn't the character named Gigolo Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
For those of you who might be confused, of course, this is all from AI, Artificial Intelligence, that Spielberg directed in 2001, 2002?
Yep. 2001.
Yeah, so it's an interesting movie. Like, it's not my favorite Spielberg movie by a country mile, but it is a very interesting movie that I think it's still going to be dissected for years to come. And I think that actually had some very profound things to say with regards to AI.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there is a Harry Mudd connection that can be made
AI.
But I think that could bring some things here in that, look, I think what we're lacking right now is kind of a personified antagonist of any sorts.
Yeah. Cause computers aren't the most, I mean, I say that, but, you know, HAL 9000 is pretty, you know, legendary as a villain.
Yeah, name one more that doesn't have that kind of personified.
Ultron.
He was personified, though.
Oh, he was personified. Oh, you're saying not personified. Yeah.
So, like, that's why I think you need kind of a personified version of an AI in order to just kind of, like, attach a real emotion to it.
I agree.
And if you pull Harry Mudd into the equation with his android obsession,
mm-hmm.
And you know what? I say that. They were doing that with Arium, though.
Yeah,
I think that's why this kind of story arc worked in this particular one. So I definitely think they want to keep pursuing that.
Yeah. I'm really curious if Discovery ever makes a point of kind of explaining why there aren't like these like cyborgs and things like that in future Star Trek.
It
seems like they're dropping hints as to why holograms won't be around. I'm just wondering if aesthetically they're going to drop hints as to why there aren't cyborgs as much.
I don't think so.
I
just think it's 100% a production values thing. Like,
have a problem with it if that is the case, but I just sometimes I wonder there's a lot of fan outcry over these things, and sometimes they cater to them.
It would profoundly bother me if the Discovery writers somehow went down that path. You know, right. I would be so clunky, you know, and just like that hologram explanation was very clunky.
What are you talking about? It's been elegant storytelling.
You know, and look, I don't need that. I don't care about that. Yeah. I'm totally wrapping my head around the fact that, yes, this is a series that has access to 2010s sort of production values. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If they could have gotten away with that, you know, back in the Next Gen era or back in the TOS era, they would have. So
which character would have been a cyborg?
No, we already had that, though, with Geordi LaForge. You
know? Oh, good point.
And we also had that with
Seven of Nine.
I don't think this is incongruent with what we already know about it. We also saw that, I think, with like background players in, say, the motion picture, for example. So
right.
This is not something.
Are you talking about the Ilya probe?
Well, no, I think there's somebody, remember in the Rec Room, I think there's somebody that looked like they had like cybernetic sort of implants or augmentation.
Were they playing that video game?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So look, this is not something that I am going to be losing.
Sure.
It would genuinely bother me that they somehow feel obligated to explain the lack of that, where we know for a fact that it is actually quite ubiquitous.
Right.
Despite it all.
So. Yeah, I have zero problem with it.
Look, we had the Barzan character. Of course, we know that in the 24th century, the Barzans are still using those apparatus. We know the Benzites need to use that apparatus, too. So I don't think there's any incongruity with what's been established in Star Trek canon at this point.
Tying it back to the whole Arium story, I really like Nahn in this episode.
Yeah.
The security chief Nahn, she didn't have a lot in terms of like heavy dramatic lifting, but I liked that this security chief seemed on the ball and was very much on to Arium before anyone else was.
Is that unlike most security chiefs from Star Trek?
Worf would have been getting hit by barrels before he realized what was going on.
Like, our knowledge of security chiefs is they're really more reactionary more than, say, preventative.
They never seem like they're actually investigating things.
And the thing that I always like about Star Trek is getting to watch characters be super competent. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that, you know, Nahn was like, this is weird. I'm keeping my eye on this.
There's that great scene where they're going through the... Well, it's not a great scene. I have issues with the minefield scene. But when they're going through that whole minefield, and you have, like, all the action going on, and then, like, Nahn, like, hiding in the doorway, peering at Arium. I thought that was great.
That's pretty much what my job would be on a starship. You know, just, you know, if it's red alert, I'm just standing in the background, gawking at everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope Nahn gets more to do, because I would like to see, like... I don't know. I think that this character could be interesting. Like, I like the idea of a really proactive security chief.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I wonder if she does get more to do, it might be on this Pike spinoff that you and I won't stop speculating about.
Yeah.
You know? So, because, of course, she came over from the Enterprise. So
Deep Space Nahn.
That is something, Cam.
Thank you.
Yeah. The other thing I think we really do want to tackle here, though, is the Burnham and Spock stuff. Because I think this is actually very, very interesting on two different levels. Of course, we have Spock acting very differently from the Spock that we know. And I think it makes a lot of sense where he says, maybe I enjoy, you know, expressing my emotions right now.
Mm-hmm.
He's been completely rattled by this entire experience with both the Red Angels as well as on Talos 4. So I think it totally makes sense that this is not the Spock we know. This is why I'm not going to be freaking out as a fan, exclaiming this is not the Spock we know. We already understand that here.
Yeah.
And I think it actually leads to some very profound exchanges between this brother-sister pair. And I think that writers are tapping into maybe some of Burnham's flaws that I wasn't so certain that if the writers were aware of the character's flaws, and that she, as Spock points out, has a certain sense of self-importance.
Right.
And B, likes to burden herself with a lot of stuff that is beyond her control, which...
Yeah, we did see in season one.
Yeah, I think both of those qualities, they're not my favorite qualities of Burnham, but...
Right.
But it is an acknowledgement that this is a complex and imperfect character, which I think is very good to do, and I think...
And that the writers seem aware of it.
Yes.
Because it's the sort of thing that, like, you know, fans will nitpick about. And often you go like, do they actually know that behind the scenes?
Yeah, and the writers maybe double down on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the speeches just get more and more over the top. But I felt like this was a real acknowledgement that, like, this is actually a flawed character, which, thank God, you know, I think Star Trek should all be flawed characters, and we get to see them all work through their own individual journeys. That's what, you know, great dramatic storytelling usually is.
It's about you know, learning a little bit more about humanity through individuals that are experiencing very human-like situations.
Yeah, like, you don't want perfect characters. That's really boring.
I mean, look at me. I'm the most boring person that you'll ever meet.
Well, there's no way for me to answer that.
Well, no, I mean, I would like to say that humility is my greatest, you know, points that I have going for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But no, like, I really liked that. Yeah, like, there was cracks in the Burnham character here, as well as cracks in the Spock character. So, like, our allegiances kind of went back and forth to each character, where you're like, just by virtue of the fact Burnham's the star of the show, initially we kind of go in more on her point of view of, like, well, Spock's obviously still pretty rattled after this whole experience, and he's the one that's maybe needs to be a little more centered. Whereas when Spock starts making points against her, we're like, yeah, wait a second.
Like, and I kind of appreciated that they were going there, because I think that writers would be reluctant to expose the main character as somebody who could be legit wrong, even though I think we kind of sort of got that throughout much of season one, at least with her redemption arc.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, even though I guess firing on the Klingons first would have been the right idea. I don't know.
I'm still unclear on
that. I'm very unclear about that whole, you know. Sorry about the mutiny.
Yeah, yeah.
But
no, and then I loved how that whole big, you know, debate between the two of them pays off in the end with Burnham having to, you know, pull the latch and fire Arium into space.
Yeah.
Like, it actually...
No, she didn't, though. Remember, it was Non that was the one
who
did.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. But no, I mean...
Because Burnham wasn't willing to do that, and I think that actually taps into her flaw as a character, where she's placing this burden on herself once again. So no matter this confrontation between her and Spock, it didn't quite get through to her, which I think is another one of her
flaws.
But
you still have Spock bringing that up in that scene.
Yes.
Which is what makes it even better.
But do you think that had it not been Spock urging her to do this, and we did see Pike urging her to pull the latch as well, do you think that it would have actually worked better for her? Like, she would have actually been willing to do that had she not been hearing it from Spock, who had that... Look, Spock was being absolutely brutal to her, just bringing up her parents' like death and everything. That had to be the most mean-spirited version of Spock I have ever witnessed in Star Trek.
Oh, that's a good point. That's an interesting point.
He was emotional, though.
I'm trying to think if I've seen Spock be more mean-spirited. That's a good question.
He was legit emotional in this, and mean-spiritedness is not something I ever associate with Spock.
You know,
he can be callous. He can be cold, but I don't ever think that he has a mean-spirited intention behind it all.
Right.
And this was for sure mean-spirited. Right. I think this is a very therapeutic thing for Spock. He's getting it all out there, stuff that he's had bottled up for decades, really.
Right.
And I think it makes sense with his own arc. I think there needs to be a release valve if you're this half-human, half-Vulcan character at a certain point.
What better release valve than siblings?
Yes.
Because you can kind of have those squabbles between the two of them. And it can get really heated, but you know that, like, they'll probably settle it out. Whereas if it's two colleagues, it gets uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, if she has this sort of fight with, like, say, Tilly or, you know, Arium, you know, that's, like, kind of uncomfortable. But when it's with family, you kind of understand all these kind of underlying complications that lie within family dynamics.
Which, there's no one better at pushing somebody's buttons than family members.
Yeah, like, of course.
You know exactly what's going to get under their skin, and they know exactly what to do to get under your skin.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh.
But ugh. I love that Spock was the one bringing up Burnham kind of refusing to grieve things and always trying to take on the burden herself in that scene, because I feel like when Spock says
Should her name be Michael Burden?
It is now.
Yeah.
But I feel like when Spock says these things, the viewer takes it more seriously.
Right.
Because Spock is such a character we know as generally being truthful. You know, like, Spock doesn't lie. Vulcans don't lie.
Yeah.
And so we take what he says at face value, but also understand, like, there's a certain gravitas behind the statement that we take meaning from. Whereas, like, if another, say, like, just Saru says it. I love Saru. But I don't know if we take it as seriously. Or if, you know, Pike says it, we're like, well, the guest star of season two said it. I don't know that I really necessarily buy into this. But there's something about Spock saying it, that character just has that sort of authority to say these things that we take as meaningful and truthful.
Yeah. So, brutal sibling showdown.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I'm really interested to see where they go. This actually reminded me in some ways of, like, the Kelvin verse, especially the first movie, Spock, where you had a little more of that temper that came out and a little more of that emotion that would kind of burst through. Like, it wasn't quite under control like it is, you know, later down the road.
Under control, huh? Yeah. The other big Spock sequence, though, I think is what was going on with, say, Stamets as well.
Because I was getting frustrated with Stamets in this episode.
Not acknowledging...
I was like, are you kidding me? We just had, like, Culber say, you know, leave me alone, move on. And then we just cut to, like, Stamets working away, being like, can you guys talk a little louder?
Do-do-do.
Yeah, do-do-do. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
Well, but the reason why you're getting frustrated is because it seems as if that's kind of been his arc throughout much of the season, just not acknowledging what's going on in his own home.
Until you get to an episode that actually focuses on it, and then it's back to normal the next week. Yeah.
But let's break it down, though. We find out that Culber has packed up and left the quarters. He needs his space. And Spock has something that applies. I mean, this is what good writing does, but it applies to both him as well as Culber. But it says that he needs the distance because maybe he doesn't know how to feel about himself.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what we're getting with the Spock and Burnham relationship, is he needs that distance between him and his sister because this is a very complex relationship.
Right.
And
it works out fine, though, in the long run.
Well, obviously, he never wanting to speak of your sister ever again means things all work out.
Yeah.
You know? So, look, he needs his distance, though, because he doesn't know how to feel about himself. And look, the idea that Spock was never somebody who had emotional issues is just such a misnomer in Trek, though. It is somebody we saw throughout the original series was constantly, constantly struggling with his own emotions.
Right.
And I think it changed for sure after...
The
movies. What was that ritual that he went through in the motion picture? I know.
See, now all I'm thinking is Kaminar, which is the planet Saru's from, but that's just immediately what pops to mind.
It sounds very similar to that. I know it's a ka sound.
Yeah.
So, but after he went through that ritual, it was a very different Spock. And think about it, we also had the Spock in, say, The Search for Spock, who came out as a very different Spock as well. And same in, The Voyage Home. This is a kind of a character who's constantly changing, but he's also constantly struggling with his emotional state. And I think this is very telling that I can buy the fact that he is always forever going to be distant from his sister. This is a guy that, you know, Jim didn't even know about his father whatsoever until Sarek actually visited and journeyed to Babel. I can buy the fact that he doesn't really talk much about his fully human half, well, not even half sister, like foster sister, and as he said, not by blood.
I love those snide Spock comments. And this is also a younger Spock too than the Nimoy original series, which I think is something that also has to be factored in when we look at how this compares to the classic versions of Spock.
Yeah.
And I'm really liking what Ethan Peck's doing with this character. I never seen Ethan Peck in anything, and I'm really impressed with just how confident he seems in this role, because this is a pretty daunting role.
Especially knowing that you are being tasked with playing a character that is quintessentially known for being very stoic, you have to play him in a much more emotional way.
Yeah.
And I think they've been setting up, you know, we even saw it with marketing with Burnham saying, Spock, is that a smile? Or was that Pike that said that?
I think it was Pike.
So somebody noticed that he was smiling. And I think if you want to reintroduce such who must be the most iconic character in all of Star Trek, you have to be doing something different with the character. Otherwise, he's just doing this really awkward imitation of Nimoy, which, look, if we do get that Pike spinoff, maybe that's what he'll kind of be doing week to week.
Right.
But I remember making a comment to you when I was making my way through Enterprise. And I had mixed feelings, you know, back in the day. I actually gave up on Enterprise midway through its run until you and fallen comrade Benjamin Yong went ahead and convinced me to rewatch it. And I was making a comment to you. I was just like, T'Pol seems to be like the most emotional Vulcan we've ever encountered in Star Trek. But it's just fascinating to go through these very Vulcan characters that we know of and realize this is a constant thread throughout all Vulcans.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating how we can kind of break down our, you know, preconceptions of such an iconic alien.
Yeah, like I always felt like Spock on the original series, a lot of the emotion does come through in various episodes.
Yeah.
Especially like episodes like A Mock Time or something like that. Like the ones that really touch on the emotions within him.
Yeah.
Or This Side of Paradise.
I was going to say that too.
Yeah, yeah. I do feel like when you got to the Burnham era, the Vulcans were not portrayed that way. They often just came across as kind of icy.
There weren't really any significant Vulcan characters. We had Sarek make a guest appearance. We had, you know, Nimoy do, really, let's be honest, like one episode, even despite appearing in the last 1 second of that cliffhanger.
Yeah, and Tarek and Vorik.
Well, Tuvok. Yeah, you know, Tuvok, yeah. But like beyond that, we just didn't get a lot of, you know, Vulcan kind of journeys.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, and even the Tuvok ones were pretty minor stuff. Like, they didn't spend a lot of time on Tuvok, so.
I think Tuvok was probably the most buttoned-down version of a Vulcan we've ever seen on Star Trek.
Yeah.
But even he had those emotional issues that he dealt with.
Right. Speaking of Vulcans, what have you thought of this whole ongoing logical extremist stuff?
I don't know what to think of it. I'm still uncertain what these logical extremists' ultimate goal is.
I don't even understand them, really. I'm like, okay.
They take logic to the extreme?
Yes, and they really, you know, reject, you know, like, say, like, Spock in society. Like, okay, they want, like, a pure Vulcan race, I guess? Uh-huh. Like, in terms of just, like, 100% logic, and there's no room for, you know, 0.1 off of that,
like a half human would introduce chaos into this logical society,
right?
Okay,
but the thing is, like, I feel like they need to spend a little more time with what a logical extremist is and like what makes them important or interesting.
Yeah,
they just throw around the term a lot, and it's
you don't really know what it means.
No, it's kind of just a like a jargon term for like bad guys.
Yeah,
because we haven't seen them presented as positive.
No.
It's always tied to bad things. Either. Like blowing themselves up on that shuttle with Sarek.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, okay, they're the guys who are going to do, like, basically, like, terrorism acts.
Isn't it kind of a oxymoronic name as well? Like, is extremism ever logical?
One would think no.
So, there you go.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just wonder how much longer we're going to be hearing about these logic extremists, but we've had them around since season one.
I know.
Do you think they're kind of a bit of an offshoot from, you know, kind of those elements that we saw during the Kishara arc on Enterprise?
I mean, it's quite possible, but the thing is, there are a lot of viewers watching Discovery who did not watch previous Star Trek shows.
That's true.
You cannot just be dropping these terms like logic extremists and assume that these people know what these things even mean.
Yeah.
Because I barely even understand what it means.
I think to the fault of the writers, they really haven't fleshed out what we're supposed to be getting out of it. And so when you have just kind of this amorphous sort of terminology, you're like, okay, they're bad guys.
Yeah.
We get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, another question I had for you, I guess, about this episode is we got a lot of stuff with Cornwell here coming back and then going on this journey to the Section 31 base.
Are your feelings about Cornwell, like, getting more and more mixed as we journey with her, you know, from, you know, her genocidal attempts to using mines, you know, that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Like, I thought she started off as kind of like a great admiral, kind of the one that we've always hoped to have.
And when you had her on that Klingon ship going, you know, kind of toe-to-toe dramatically with Laurel.
Yeah.
And then talking Ash Tyler through his, what was at that point considered PTSD spell. I mean, like, stuff like that was fantastic. I really thought Cornwell was this great admiral character that the show has not just this show, but all Star Trek in general has long failed to really deliver of these great admiral characters.
But she seems to be more and more falling into that camp of having more bad apple tendencies than we originally would have suspected. And I kind of wish we had like an admiral we could get behind 100%, very much like they are positioning Pike as a captain we can get behind 100%. Do you think she was a little bit too generous with all the praise she was heaping all over Pike? Like to me, it got to be a little embarrassing how she was like, we had you on the sidelines because we needed to have all the values of the Federation embodying one magnificent man, and that man is you.
The best of what the Federation has to offer.
Yeah.
Dr. Boyce. there was one line that just killed me, too, because she says, like, you know, the best the Federation has to offer. I'm like, okay, fine. And then she says, as this conversation makes clear, I'm talking about you. And I was like, that is thrown in there because the writers do not have confidence that the viewers picked up what she means.
I kind of find that insulting. I hate lines like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also just kind of bad writing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
As this conversation makes clear.
it's just like, yes, we understand what you're saying. You don't need to repeat it and then drive it home, you know, like a nail through our brains, like once again.
It's like when characters say, so what you're saying is this character is my brother. Yes. That's what you're saying. Yeah.
Don't you hate it when you're watching like movies or TV shows and you're like, hey, bro. Hey, sister.
Right, right.
Like, that's how you introduce kind of the characters, where if you just kind of watch the characters interact, you can kind of figure out the relationship.
Yeah.
The easiest way around that, though, is just if you have the two sibling characters say, hey, do you remember that time mom did this or that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is very natural.
There's shorthand ways of going about this, and I like this kind of clunky writing. I'm kind of insulted that they think that the average Star Trek viewer is just this dumb that they don't pick up on what's being you know, delivered here.
And I feel like the ones that don't pick it up, the handful that don't, they don't really care that much.
That's true.
And like throwing in an extra line like this, it's not like they're like, oh wow. I feel like it's just like, eh, okay.
Yeah.
This is where the episode kind of frustrated me, is all of this stuff about the journey to the Section 31 base. Like, Cornwell shows up, I'm like, okay, where is this episode going? And it just felt like it was like kind of adrift, a lot of it, of like, okay, we're going to the Section 31 base. Cool. Is this what this episode is about, the trip to the Section 31 base? Because it sure felt like it for a long time.
You joked at a certain point where they sat down to play chess.
Yeah.
And then cut to commercial. And you said, this is the rest of the episode. We're just going to watch them play three-dimensional chess.
Yeah. Because that was about 20-something minutes in.
Yeah.
And I was still going like, what is this episode? Like, I really... There was a point, and it was after that point, like, I was beginning to think, like, this is going to be a rough podcast episode, because I don't know how much I have to say about the journey to the Section 31 base.
Well, I'll say, every time we come into an episode, I think we want to have kind of a central question for us to grapple with.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are episodes where I've watched, and I'm like, I don't know what the question is that we're trying to answer here. I think the biggest example of that is Point of Light.
Sure.
The Klingon heavy episode, where we came out of that and I was just like, I don't even know what we're supposed to be talking about.
Right, right. Here.
This was one up until, you know, kind of the Spock Burnham confrontation. I was like, okay, at least we have this to kind of jump on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with the Arium stuff, that's where it really all came together.
Yeah, when the Arium stuff really kicked in, then you could say, this episode matters. This episode has a definite reason to exist, as opposed to just a journey from point A to next week will be point B.
Yeah.
You know, that was my concern, was like, we were going to journey to the Section 31 base the whole episode, get there, there was going to be some sort of shocking reveal, and then next week would pick up on the Section 31 base.
Right.
But like, that whole minefield sequence I thought was really weak. Like, I was just thinking, oh my God, how long are we going to stretch this out? Because I'm just watching mines bounce off this ship. I'm like, well, I don't know how many mines it takes to kill the Discovery.
And we kind of know that they're not going to destroy the ship.
Yeah. And it's just like...
The titular ship.
Yeah. And it's just like showing these things bounce off the ship. There doesn't seem to be that much damage whatsoever.
Yeah.
And like, what? It just doesn't... It's not the sort of action scene I find in any way exciting.
But haven't we seen these types of action scenes done much more effectively? And that's just it. It's just kind of like, I've seen this done better in other TV shows or movies, you know, with not necessarily space mines,
sure,
but like a certain sort of situation.
And, well, I think of like the Tholian Web from the original series, where it's, you know, a similar, this big hazard in space they have to deal with. And it's done through problem solving and strategy. I think that's way more interesting than this kind of drive through it and then just saying things like, we have to introduce chaos.
No, but you know, the one thing that it did tie back to emotionally in this is the game that Burnham was playing with Spock. And...
But did you feel like they introduced chaos in a way that was that clear to you?
Not really.
It was Saru saying, you know, attack pattern delta of whatever, or whatever he said.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
And then they're like, yep, that worked.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, sure, whatever.
It's not the super smart sort of Breaking Bad problem solving that you would hope that they could figure out.
Yeah, it's sort of the equivalent of the old, you know, really popular in like Voyager and TNG to a degree, the Techno Babble answer.
Yeah.
you know, we just got to shift the pattern buffers or something like that. And it's like, okay, that worked. And you're like, well, there you go.
Speaking of the trip to Section 31 base, I was looking at the frozen bodies.
Star Trek VI, the undiscovered country.
With that with the blood floating. And with the gravity boots and everything, which, yeah, I dig. But then I was thinking about the frozen bodies, and there's that one Andorian that we saw. It's just like, oh, that antenna must have snapped off at a certain point. Like, that would have, you know, that, like.
That's grim.
And to me, I just went like, ooh, you know.
I was kind of bummed to see our really sole Andorian character dead, as well as our Tellarite character.
Do we know that those are the same? Well, they said the admirals that control Section 31.
Yeah.
So I guess, and then they said that was Admiral Pitar. So yeah, that must have been those admirals.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That was them,
Okay, I'm sure we'll get more Andorians and Tellarites at a certain point.
I mean, I guess they weren't that dynamic of characters that I'm that broken up about it, but...
name any of them.
I can't.
I think the Andorian or the Tellarite, I think one of them was named, like, Grawl.
Right.
That's the best I can come up with. But one other thing that I do want to point out, though, with the end credits, did you notice it was a little different than usual, Cam?
Yeah, they didn't cut to commercial.
Yeah, which is interesting, and I think the reason why, though, is it was silent. You know, we had the death of a character.
Yeah.
And it was, and this is kind of something they do in a lot of TV shows, though, and, like, to honor that, they'll have, you know, no music playing over. It'll kind of hit you more with the emotion. Yeah. I don't recall Lorca getting that treatment upon his demise after he turned heel, and we suddenly discovered that he was a bad guy this whole time.
Well, I think it's a little different when it's a villain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just thought that was kind of an interesting twist that they introduced here, especially for a character who, let's be honest, Kent, was a background player for like 15 episodes.
Yes, I agree 100%. So where do you think the future of Section 31 is at this point? Because, you know, we had these admirals that seemed to be going back and forth with Leland. They're now out of the picture. This AI has apparently gone amok. Like, what does this mean for Section 31 as we know it? So, you know, Ash Tyler's in his room somewhere this whole episode.
This is where I'm getting really frustrated with some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, is because we know that there's all this talk about, you know, giving Georgiou her own sort of Section 31 spinoff.
Yeah.
But, like, Alex Kurtzman was doing interviews this week saying that the earliest we'd ever see it would be post-season 3 of Star Trek Discovery. So if it ever happens, it's way down the road. But the thing is, it seems as if they're trying to go down the path where this situation is unfolding, and this would be the situation that would drive Section 31 underground. Like, this is why nobody's heard of them 100 years from now when they're first introduced in the 24th century.
Yeah.
You know, but now it seems as if they're going to keep plugging along if this Georgiou spinoff goes ahead.
Right.
And so are we going to be spending a season? Are we going to be spending multiple seasons watching Georgiou do Black Ops or something?
Well, and Kurtzman has said there is going to be a guaranteed spot for Michelle Yeoh in season 3.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know.
Like, I don't like this. Like to me, this, I find this frustrating to watch, because the thing is, the more we see of Section 31, the more of their mysteriousness, you know, it is scrubbed away, and they look dopier and dopier, like, every moment.
It's kind of like the whole giving Joker an origin story.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just are better off not knowing.
Exactly. But in this situation, okay, so what we find out is Section 31, or at least Control, has been compromised. We know that, like, the space base has eliminated the leadership of Section 31.
Yeah.
So they don't look tough. They don't look on top of things. You also wonder, how come Section 31 didn't save, you know, the Federation from the Klingon War if their methods are really all that effective?
Yeah, and how many members of Section 31 are there?
It's so unclear. Two?
It seems like it's like Ash Tyler, Georgiou, and Leland.
Yeah.
Like, so, we're not getting a good sense of the scale of their operations.
I don't know. I'm just, you and I aren't all that interested in, like, a Section 31 spinoff. It just, and I don't think season 2 has made them look cool at all.
I don't really know what they're doing with them.
No.
They're using them for a lot for just plot mechanics to get things to happen. You know, we saw in several episodes, they just showed up to save the day in certain key scenes, or eliminated characters in key moments, things like that. But, like, at this point forward, it just seems like they were mostly there as a smokescreen for this AI. It's all about, oh, what's
Haley Section... Joel Osment.
What's Section 31 up to? It's like, oh, it's not actually them. It's the AI. It's control that seems to be working independently. So they are basically now nothing?
I don't know.
Like, Leland, we always knew Leland was kind of a joke, or at least we knew pretty quickly. And so now that character has even less fearsomeness going on with him. You can kind of just toss him aside. Ash Tyler's in his room. Who knows what he's doing? Giorgio
is... He's tying knots. Nautical knots.
Giorgio's a wild card who will happily just jump ship to the next, you know, thing anyway. And so it doesn't feel like Section 31 as a group is in any way stable or even in a position to be doing interesting things on an ongoing show.
Yeah.
I just don't know what to make of this whole operation, this whole Section 31 operation. And the thing is, like, had you built Section 31 over, say, like, you know, 3-4 seasons of Discovery, and then kind of pulled the rug out from the viewer in a sense of had something, like, had they been corrupted then by their control, you might have a little more investment in seeing it fall apart, because you would have had a good understanding at that point, just in terms of how they operate and how things work and all that sort of thing. But we don't really have that, and so we've just kind of got this very vaguely sketched organization crumbling, and you go, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so really all of our fondness for it comes from Deep Space Nine.
Exactly.
That does not resemble this at all.
And the Deep Space Nine version was far more mysterious.
Yes.
And the very fact that we saw like a total of like maybe 3 uniformed Section 31 members throughout that entire run.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you had, look, Admiral Ross was never going to be a cool character, but the fact that you can see that he was compromised by that as well.
Yeah.
So, Cam, as we wrap up here, I do want to get a little bit into the Red Angel stuff.
Yeah.
In which I think there's a lot of theories going around. I know that whatever guesses we have were probably going to be wrong, but I think what we're getting more and more hints of is there is like a very special connection between Spock and Burnham that is tied to the Red Angel. And this emphasizes that. So I am curious as to where we're going. Are you getting more invested in this Red Angel stuff? Are you more invested in, say, kind of what the AI antagonist that the Red Angel seems to be fighting against is kind of going forward with? Or where are you right now with this whole Red Angel arc?
You know, the last episode gave us quite a bit more with the Red Angel kind of framing it. We got to then kind of play the guessing game, which was fun. This week didn't really give me that much more. It was more about the reveal of the AI taking over.
Yeah.
And, of course, what it, you know, was going to happen with Arium. The Red Angel stuff, I mean, you know, we had little teases of, like, why does it communicate with you, Spock, and that sort of thing. But, frankly, at this point, I think they just need to expose what the Red Angel is so that we can then deal with what that means. And the next episode is called The Red Angel, so...
Yeah, but much like how this episode is called Project Daedalus,
and they
never actually got into it.
Yeah.
It was. Maybe we won't find out until episode 11 what the Red Angel
is. That's quite possible. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, I'm kind of in the position of just like, well, just wait and see. But I don't feel like the Red Angel mystery is building. Like, it doesn't feel like it's escalating in a way that you are kind of on the edge of your seat waiting to find out. You know, you think of like, you know, you referenced Breaking Bad earlier and the way they would build to the end of the season where you were just like, on pins and needles to see what was going to happen. I feel like they want us to be feeling those types of emotions regarding the Red Angel story, and I'm just not.
The issue is, though, is the writers are kind of reverse engineering it. They know exactly what the Red Angel is, where it's going, and so they're starting off with little morsels for the audience, but it's really hard to ask for the audience to get invested in something that they don't know what it is even constitutionally.
Yeah.
So you just hear this very amorphous Red Angel, and it's just kind of like, I don't know, why should I care? And I don't think they've done a great job of doing that until I would say like the last episode, the one if memory serves. I think that was the first time that I was actually intrigued by any of this Red Angel stuff.
I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really get exciting until it's actually revealed who it is.
Yeah.
In which case, then we can really talk about what this means and the ramifications for the story of the season and going forward and all that sort of stuff. But at this point, we don't have anything to hold on to.
Cam, I'm telling you, it's Deanna Troi.
Well,
I've seen
that theory floated more than a couple times now.
Well, you know, we do have a voicemail from a listener here with her own thoughts on the Red Angel. So why don't we listen to that right now?
Hi, Tyler and Cam. My name is CJ, and I'm a new listener, but I'm trying to catch up on everything. Anyway, I just had this thought, and I needed to share it with somebody, so I'm going to share it with you. I was thinking about how the spore drive was able to get them into the mycelial network. And, like, I have this weird feeling after Janine said that she thought maybe it was Culber that was in the Red Angel suit. And I'm thinking someone goes in the spore drive somehow, that whoever, something happens in the spore drive that causes the Red Angel person to go through time, and that person becomes the Red Angel, yada, 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 and that whatever happened is the reason that the spore drive is not ever used again. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm making sense.
Hey, CJ, I think you are making some sense here, because I like the idea of tying the Red Angel back to the whole spore drive question, which is just this lingering question over the entire series. I think the fact that they are dispatching with Arium is signaling that maybe season two will be kind of the end of the spore drive narrative.
We've had a lot of, you know, breadcrumbs dropped about the spore drive throughout the season. We've had those aliens saying that you're killing us when you use a spore drive. We've had this episode where Spock's talking to Stamets about what the issues are with the controlling of the spore drive. Is it the driver? Is it the whatever, the networker, whatever, however he phrased it. They keep bringing it up for something that is apparently going to be, you know, sidelined because, you know, it's just not ready yet. They are bringing it up a lot in season two and tying it into these ongoing stories. And at this point, why do we need it?
I don't think it's off base to think that there are connections here.
Yes, so I agree 100%.
Because it really seems as if the spore drive was meant to be shut down by the end of season one.
Yeah.
And I think maybe they're just... And look, it makes no sense that they're still using it. It really does not, unless, of course, it is tied somehow to the overall season two arc.
Yeah, because I think they are going to be looking at ways of getting rid of it in a way that has some finality to it. Because otherwise, it's just that lingering question that just annoys everyone.
So then what does Stamets do after? What is his role in the ship? It's tough because we already have Burnham as the chief science officer.
Right.
Stamets is a scientist as well. He was talking about packing up all his gear and going to, what, that's university or something like that.
Right.
In the season premiere. So I don't know what we do with Stamets without the spore drive. And I really think this character has been lost for season two,
a lot of season one as well.
Yeah, so I question very much what his role is going to be if that navigator position is taken away.
Well, okay. I mean, a lot depends on what happens with the captain situation in season three, because who knows? Maybe Saru and Burnham get promotions, which opens up a science officer position.
Both of them get promoted. Oh, like maybe Burnham becomes first officer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, we don't really know, right? Like, I get the sense that Discovery wants to shake up a little bit of the command structure every season.
Yeah. I think we can... it's almost a guarantee that Pike will not be the captain in season three, right?
Yeah. But I also then also have problems believing that Saru's the captain in season three. Like, I just...
Yeah.
I would like a Captain Saru. I think he's a great character, and I think you could definitely get good stuff out of it, but it almost feels too soon.
I know what you're saying.
Unless they want to do... Okay.
But that's why I think they introduced the Vorahai in very early on in the season to kind of give a different sort of Saru, one who isn't so tangled up by this, you know, threat ganglia slash, like, constant fear of death guiding every decision.
I wonder, you know, you and I have floated the theory that, like, Discovery goes maybe five seasons. Like, five seasons sounds like a good number, right, for a show nowadays? I wonder if they would do something where it's like, Saru's a captain for season three and four, and then we get a season of Burnham as a captain in the final season.
And
something
then we have
like that.
Admiral Saru taking over from Cornwall.
Sure. Or he, you know, gets his another ship. Like, it's kind of like Sulu going getting the Excelsior or something.
And
maybe we'd finally get, like, the Star Trek fleet show in season five.
Sure.
Something like that.
Well, look, if they can wedge Ash Tyler in for no good reason whatsoever, then I'm sure they can find a way to wedge Saru in.
Yeah.
So he would be playing, kind of like a seconded captain aboard Discovery. For some reason.
Unless we're still going to pick up that Vulcan captain waiting on.
I like how nobody's ever spoken about that captain ever. Like, that captain's still hanging around on Vulcan. Much like how no one has mentioned Lorca once since the season premiere.
I know. It's so weird, right?
Yeah.
I like to think that that Vulcan captain is kind of like a Han situation in The Fast and the Furious, where he just keeps going like, I just got to get to Tokyo. I wish they had just done that through the season. We just got to go pick up that captain. We just got to go pick up that captain.
Do you think Burnham went by the captain when she landed on Vulcan a couple episodes back?
It would be amazing if when she was like taking off, he was like sitting there just like,
wait for me,
at the landing yard, like looking like really bored.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll see. I'm looking forward to the next few episodes, because we're really going to get to where we're going. And as much as I enjoy the journey of Star Trek seasons, Discovery puts you in these weird situations where the destination becomes a lot more important than it should be.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I'm somebody who does prefer the journey more than the destination.
Yeah.
So, and look, what keeps working for me on Star Trek Discovery is the character moments.
Yeah.
And we both agree, like, those are the two strongest things going on in an episode that I would rather say is a kind of a middling episode of Discovery Season 2.
Yeah, and I think the one thing is, like, Discovery Season 2 has, even if the stories sometimes wander or are, you know, have some stuff in them that doesn't work, they have these moments that just are just huge show-stopping moments. And this episode had a number of them, and I thought they were all great for the most part. And we didn't see as many of those in season one.
Right.
So if they can somehow refine their storytelling just a little more and still include those moments, season three could be amazing. Like, I feel like we are on the track to something.
And I think
to something really, you know, this is a really good show, but I think we could get to great sooner than maybe some fans will say.
Well, and you know what? Look, season two, we already know that it's suffering from some behind the scenes chaos,
of course,
too.
Yeah.
So look, if there is some good continuity and there is some order brought to the production going forward, mm-hmm. that can only be a good thing.
Exactly. Okay. So on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have more videos up this week tackling the latest episode of Discovery. Tyler, I guess next week we're doing The Red Angel.
Yeah, we
which
are.
Which I'm very much looking forward to.
Hopefully we'll get some answers, but maybe it's really going to be more of a journey to Project Daedalus.
I'm just worried because we had the death of Arium in this episode. You know we're due for the filler episode.
I know.
Well, we'll see.
No, but you know what? This, I think, like, if you go by the patterns where it's like one big episode followed by more of a connective tissue sort of episode.
Yeah.
Next one's supposed to be big. Like, I don't think you can call it The Red Angel.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a dud. Or at least they intended to be one of those filler episodes.
Yeah.
So I'll hang on to hope.
Let's see.
Yeah.
Okay. You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very good job, Jonathan Frakes. Very good job, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in non, comma, deep space.
Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.